UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
To be looking at the self at the end of the 20th century, I couldn't resist that one. Shapers, the church at the end of the 20th century. Here we're going to look at the self at the end of the 20th century. And I'm attempting, in a very general, broad way, to do a portrait of the modern self. Now, because all of us who are here tonight are selves, who are part of the modern world, I think all of us, if I'm correct, will be, to one degree or other, included in this portrait. So it has something to say to all of us, because we're all modern selves. And what I really want to know is this. What makes the modern self tick? And how does the modern self relate to the other? How do we relate to that reality which is outside of us? Now, trying to get inside the modern self is an almost impossible task. And you'll see this as we go along. And the reason that it's almost impossible is because it's the very nature of the self to be elusive. There is nothing more hidden to the self than the self. That's something I'm going to elucidate as we go along. And yet here we are tonight trying to pin down the self, and that's going to be a challenge. Now I want to warn you before I kick off that this is not a feel-good lecture. It's not what you might call a psychological thriller. In fact, I'm going to shoot myself in the foot before I begin. It's going to have a heavy feel. The material, because this is a Labrie lecture, is going to be dense and very tightly argued. I do apologize for that. And then, more than that, my conclusions about the state of the modern self are very depressing. I've been thinking about this for a long time now, and I've often backed off from it. I thought, no, I can't handle any more of this. So, no feel-good factors tonight, but I hope it'll stimulate you to think. And many of you will probably disagree with me, and some of you are going to be angry at me. But please don't take it personally. And then after this lecture, let's discuss it as coherently as we can together. Now, by way of introduction, and in the interest of getting our minds into gear for this roller coaster ride, I want to begin with a track from a Pink Floyd album. You're surprised, aren't you? And this is a track from the album The Wall. I call it the greatest concept album of all times. And it's the track Hey You. And it's a haunting picture of someone who feels lost and alienated. And I think it's a way in to understanding the modern self. So I'm going to play it, and I'll put the lyrics up, and you can follow this through together. Now, I actually think this album, The Wall, is the perfect metaphor, in many respects, for the modern self. But I want to kick into gear now on a much more ancient picture of the modern self. And what I'm going to do now is retell one of the Greek myths which bear directly on our subject tonight. Now, there's many versions of this myth. This is the Andrew version. It's the myth which tells the story of Narcissus. Many of you will know this story. Narcissus is a very handsome young man who's rather arrogant and self-centered. But that, of course, doesn't deter the young ladies from falling in love with him. And though he likes their attention, he spurns their advances. But there was one young lady in particular who was especially attracted to him, and she did everything she could to attract the attention of Narcissus. And yet, as much as she tried to win the affections of Narcissus, he ignored her. Well, one day in desperation, this young woman prayed to a goddess. She said, "Please make Narcissus return the love and the affection I have for him." But this was one of those prayers to which there was no answer. Have you ever prayed that before? It's amazing how often that one's not answered. Well, finally, at her wit's end, she prayed that Narcissus would learn, as she had, what it was to love someone without the return of that love. And it was this prayer that did get answered. Because one day as Narcissus was walking through the forest, he stumbled upon a quiet fountain. And as he knelt down to drink from it, he was captivated by what peered back at him from inside the fountain. For peering back at him was the most beautiful sight he had ever laid his eyes upon. There's someone with beautiful hair and wonderful eyes and a healthy complexion. And because good old Narcissus had never seen a more lovely sight in his life, he immediately fell in love with this image, which of course was his own image reflected in the pool. And he's so in love with this image that he struggles as much as possible to get close to it. But every time he bends down to kiss it, it just disappears. Now this sight is so engaging for Narcissus that he can't leave it. In fact, he loses all of his desire for food and for drink in the light of this captivation. And it isn't long before Narcissus begins to wither. He begins to lose his health and his beauty. And in the end, Narcissus finally dies staring at his own image in the fountain, striving to embrace the one object of his desire, which is himself. Now, I tell this story, this myth, because it is my conviction that the modern self has become narcissistic. And I think there are a number of critical factors within our culture which has produced a new character, the modern self, which is narcissistic. Now, what is narcissism? What do I mean by this term? Well, narcissism is part of the terminology of psychology. It's a psychological term. And good old Sigmund Freud was the first to use the term as a description of a psychological condition. He actually began to use it to describe that very early stage in childhood in which the baby can't see a reality beyond himself or herself. And having just had a baby, I looked very carefully to see if I could spot this trend. I have to say, I couldn't quite see it. But somehow Freud saw it, and he says that the baby doesn't see mother as someone who is separate from his or her existence. The baby lacks the ability to think in terms of subject-object, that is, I, the subject, you, outside of me, the object. No, the baby looks at the mother and says, I am you. You're simply an extension of me. Now, Freud recognized this similar trait in some of his adult patients. And it was here that narcissism became known as a psychological condition. Now, narcissism as a psychological condition is extremely complicated. I've been collating some material on it, and it's over my head because everyone's disagreeing with each other. And there's actually little consensus about it, even as a clinical condition. But essentially, it's a situation where there's an extreme preoccupation with the self. And like narcissism, a person is unable to look beyond the self, and in the process ends up destroying the self. Now, when I describe tonight the modern self as being narcissistic, I am not talking about a clinical narcissism. I don't want to frighten anybody here. It's actually a very rare diagnosis in the field of psychology. There are not many clinical narcissists. I don't think I've ever met one, and I doubt that any of you here tonight are clinically narcissistic. So please don't get frightened. I'm simply using this term to describe the modern self and the way it relates to the world. And my working definition of narcissism, describing the modern self, goes something like this. I should have written this up. It is a preoccupation with the self, which leads to a loss of meaningful touch with objective reality. It is a preoccupation with the self which leads to a loss of meaningful touch with objective reality. In the words of a good number of people that I have personally met, it is a phenomenon of living inside your head. No longer do you place yourself in a world which is outside of you. No, you just live inside your head, cut off from a meaningful contact with the rest of reality. And if I've heard it from one, I've heard it from a dozen Labrie students who say, I'm just locked inside my head. Now, because narcissism actually redefines reality and how we relate to it as subjects, what we're actually dealing with here is a worldview. And if this defines the modern self, and that's what I'm contending, what we're dealing with here is a whole way of viewing the world. And that's why I actually call this the worldview of self. You see, in becoming narcissistic, the modern self has actually reinterpreted the whole of reality. That's what I want to try and show you tonight. Narcissism has produced a whole new way of seeing and viewing the world. And it's my conviction that in the Western world, where there's a plurality of worldviews in the market, this is known as pluralism, the smorgasbord of worldviews, you can choose this one or have that one, there's all sorts on offer. There is actually one worldview which transcends all of them. And it's this one I'm talking about tonight. The worldview of self transcends all the other worldviews. In fact, the worldview of self, for me, is the one meta-narrative that remains in the postmodern worlds. The grand story. This is the grand story which defines what reality is. The worldview of self. And it's a story which is lived out inside of my head. Now, at the end of the day, this is the only reality that actually exists. The reality that is inside my head. And that's because the worldview of self can't look beyond the self. It's a worldview where we are caught within the prison of the human self. And at the end of the day, the self is all that actually exists. So when I come into a room full of people, I don't see these other people separate from myself with their own needs and personalities and problems and joys and so forth. No. Rather than acknowledging the existence of the other, I simply see them as an audience to reflect back into myself. So these are people to impress, to be admired by, to get pity from, to manipulate, to get my own ends. You see, I'm so identified with myself that the other person doesn't really exist. They're simply to be there to be available for me. So the worldview of self is one where the real outside of the self is actually lost. Now this fact that the real objective reality, and I'm going to be playing this out as we go along, that the fact that the objective reality has been lost in this worldview of self is extremely serious. And to be honest, it's something that I feel almost apocalyptic about. I've been working on this material for several years. And I've often set it down because the implications of this whole thing have just overwhelmed me. Helen said, just leave it alone for a while. Don't chill out, Andrew. Just chill out. And I come back to it. I say, oh no, it can't be true. You see, if we become so trapped within the self that we've lost touch with the real, which exists outside of the self, then I believe we're traveling down the road quickly to psychological death. And that's what the myth teaches us. That's where it's so relevant. To focus on the self to the exclusion of what is outside is to embrace death. You see, such a state of affairs is a total distortion of what God intended. It's a distortion. Because God intended that our lives be a response to that which is outside of us. So when I, the subject, encounter you as someone who exists outside of me, an objective reality outside of me, God intended that I should respond to you as you. But the narcissist can't do this. Rather than acknowledging your reality as separate to mine, I simply use you to pick up messages about myself. So when you smile, I feel great about myself. When you frown, I feel terrible about myself. You're just a mirror. That's all you are. Now this is so serious because the nature of our relationship to reality matters intensely. And all that divides us from the real, from objective reality, causes psychological tension. It's interesting. The root of all of our psychological problems, all of our psychoses and neuroses, is what's known as the divided life. And it's ultimately the division between our perceptions of reality and the way it really is. You think of the most extreme, a schizophrenic, someone who's suffering from a psychotic illness. They are so detached from reality. I'm Napoleon, I might say, and believe that. I'm so detached from the real world, the reality of who I am in the world. You see the divided life. Let me illustrate this in a diagram here. Self's perception of the real, on the left, on the right, the circle of reality. A division between the two. Now, our perceptions of the real are actually an interpretation of it. We interpret the real, the circle of reality, through sign or symbol. And we do this as human beings by means of language, art, music, and story. Through these, we recreate the worlds in our perceptions of it. But our interpretations, our perceptions, are meant to reflect what is really there. That's the point. So we have this perception of the real, this interpretation of it through signs and symbols, and it's meant to reflect what's really there. Now, when there's a gap, as there is here, between our perception of the real and the real itself, a division is created, and a type of psychosis comes on. Again, I'm not talking about a clinical psychosis. You see, the division between our perception of the real and the real itself brings a disintegration that causes a negative tension. I'm not in touch with the way things are. Now, because of the presence of sin in our world, there is always a division between our interpretation of the real and the way it really is. The two never perfectly come together because of sin. And this is actually, for me, one of the most terrible dualisms which the presence of sin creates. It creates what we call in philosophy an epistemological dilemma. That is, we don't have sufficient data to understand the real. And the data we do have, we misuse. So there's this division. Our perception of the real doesn't tie up with the way it actually is. Christianity, however, is something which is meant to restore us to the circle of reality, to put us back into the circle so our interpretation of it matches up with the way it really is. And we can do that as Christians because God has revealed to us what this reality is. So that means our interpretation now ought to correspond with what's really there. Francis Schaeffer often pointed out that substantial psychological healing comes as we move into the circle of reality, as we move from here to here. So the two marry up. As that happens, there's substantial psychological healing as we go into the circle of reality. This then bridges the division between the real and our perceptions of the real. And it brings an integration between the two which restores our psychological health. Now what I'm trying to highlight in all of this is simply that the real matters. Reality matters, and our perception of it matters. And there needs to be a relationship between the two for our psychological health. Now, when we look at this distortion which is brought on by sin in the modern world, I actually think we see a whole new level and dimension to the problem. I believe we have actually lost touch with the real, the circle of reality, altogether. So it's not a question now of misperception, it's a question of non-existence. It doesn't exist anymore. That might seem extreme, but I'm going to argue it out over this lecture. I believe that the modern self has actually gobbled up the real, the circle of reality, and the self is all that's left. We're just simply left with the modern self. Now, it's one thing to have a division between the real and our perception of the real. It's quite another to have the real effectively disappear altogether. And for me, this is the predicament of the modern self at the end of the 20th century. We have lost the real, I believe, to the degree that there is no longer a circle of reality to step into. Now, what I wanted to see from here on is the consequences of this, and I want to try and draw it out and elaborate this and prove my point. Now, it's not the intention of this lecture to comment on how we've got to this point, how we've withdrawn into the self to the point that we've lost touch with the other. And what I'm going to be doing this term in a series of lectures is actually elaborating on the causes of how the self has got to this point. I'm not doing that tonight. And you can be thankful if you're a visitor that I'm not going to do that on a Friday night. Those are going to be other days of the week. What I want to try and do now is to uncover the modern self and see the consequences of our narcissism and this loss of the real. And I want to do so under three main headings, which are up here. If you get lost, just go back to the main heading and hopefully that'll bring you back to where I am. My first heading here is the problem of self-consciousness. The problem of self-consciousness. I've already pointed out that the modern has withdrawn into the self. Now, with this being the case, it stands to reason that we have reached a very high level of self-consciousness. When the self becomes everything, we gain a state of hyper-self-consciousness. The real is gone, I'm just conscious of myself. That's all that's left. Now, I want to show that this state of hyper-self-consciousness is in itself a terrible problem. And what I'm illustrating here is the point that to focus on the self is ultimately to destroy the self. Now, in order to highlight the problem of self-consciousness, we're going to have to move for a moment into the world of semiotics or semiology. And this is the hardest part of the lecture right here. Just go with me through this bit and it'll get easier. We need to move into this world of semiotics. Semiotics is the science which deals with the way human beings, the self, uses signs, the way we use language as an example of a sign. Now, it is our ability to be sign users that make us so unique as human beings. Here we are as subjects. I'm the subject, the self, and I'm in a world of objects. overhead projector, Steve, chair, stereo system, subject in a world of objects. The question is, how do I come to know these objects? How do they become meaningful and intelligent to me? Well, the answer is this, through the use of signs and symbols. Things like language, art, stories make the object, to me the subject, meaningful. Take language as an example, and for me language is the most remarkable gift of signs which are given to us by God. Take the word apple. Now as a sign, a symbol, this word, this sound, this phonetic sound, gives meaning to that round red piece of fruit that grows in trees. It actually gives meaning to it. Now this word apple has its own unique phonetic sound, but there is so much more to this word apple than its sound. You see, when I hear or use the word apple, it conveys before me a kind of general impression of apples I've known. The sign embodies qualities of roundness, although Le Brie apples can be a bit different. Redness, because we don't spray them. Texture, and then the sound when you bite into it. That word conveys all of those things to me. It brings them up before my vision. So this word, this sign, actually helps to give meaning to the object in question. It invests something in it. And without a sign or symbol, the object itself would have no meaning. That's my point. It's signs that actually give the object meaning. Now, animals, unlike humans, do not have the ability to use signs. Animals communicate through the use of signals. There's been a lot of debate about this. Chimpanzees function as language users. It's not true. They communicate animals through the use of signals. And signals are very different from signs. A signal is an interactive thing. You say sit to the dog and it sits because it's been conditioned to respond to that particular signal, that sound. But there is no perceived meaning in the signal for the dog. It doesn't invest sit with kind of meaning. It doesn't bring all sorts of impressions into its mind. Now, when the sign is used, you have the creation of what is known as a triad. I'm almost done this bit. The triad. Triad because there's three parts to it. You've got the subject, the self, which is the sign user, has this ability. He uses the sign or the signifier, which gives meaning to the object and the signifier. There's three important parts in this equation. Now, it's by the use of the sign, using the sign, that we actually create a world for ourselves. Because we are constantly naming our world through language, through words. In fact, I'd want to suggest that there is nothing in our world which is left unnamed. We've named absolutely everything in our world. As sign users, we make a complete world for ourselves. Even the gaps in our world, the things we can't know, are called gaps. We signify them too. So the whole cosmos is accounted for somehow in our sign usage, whether it be mythically or scientifically. The past, the present, and the future are all accounted for in the world we create with signs. And that is why all people in all cultures have some kind of explanation for the world they live in. Where it came from, where it's going, and so forth. So the cosmos is totally constructed by signs. A world is imposed upon the cosmos to give it some meaning, to interpret it. Now, as I said earlier, this is meant to correspond with the way things actually are. But of course, because of sin, it will never be that perfectly. But our use of signs, as a sign user, is meant to correspond to the object. It is meant to be in the circle of reality. Now, our ability here is one of the most significant ways that we bear the image of God. It's one of our most remarkable qualities. It's been blowing my mind over the last few weeks. This language, it's such a gift. Our abilities as sign users is one of the most remarkable ways we live out our creativity, and every human being does it. It gives us the capacity to be artists. We're artists in our use of speech. We create a world in the way we use speech. And then we can go to other symbols like a drawing, piece of music, story, and so forth. And our ability to be sign users ensures the self's ability to have a relationship to the world which is full of meaning and significance. It gives our world a meaning. It gives us a way of seeing the world that brings it to life in a way the sign user couldn't. That's the good side. here's the dark side. In this capacity to be sign users is a major problem. And the problem is this. Every object in the entire cosmos can be signified by the sign user except for one thing. And that's the sign user himself or herself. The sign user lacks the ability to signify the self. We can put the self, the subject, in the middle of the world where the sign belongs. Because that would break the triad. It just wouldn't work. So we can place everything else in our world through the use of signs creating this world, but we can't place ourselves. And that means we can't know ourselves. We can't give ourselves a sign which gives us meaning. It helps us to know ourselves. As a philosopher Nietzsche said, we are unknown. We knowers to ourselves. Each is the furthest away from himself. As far as ourselves are concerned, we are not knowers. Now that is absolutely spot on. Now this is a real problem for us. We can place everything else in the world through the use of signs, but we can't place ourselves. And that means we lack a proper understanding of ourselves as self. There's something about us which is not fixed. There's something about the self which is loose. Everything else is fixed, but we're loose. We can't place ourselves. We can't signify ourselves. Now, the moment we become self-conscious, we become aware of this problem. We look at ourselves and suddenly we're aware that there's nothing fixed about us. We have no fixed means of understanding the self as self. There's no signifier which adequately reflects the self. We can't use it in that sense. And the more we look at ourselves, the more aware we become of the problem. It is very difficult to find an identity for the self. That's my point. And this is what I mean by the problem of self-consciousness. We're conscious of ourselves, we turn inwards, but we can't know ourselves. We can't place ourselves like we can the rest of the world. Now the point is this, if we were living as God intended, it would not be a problem. It would not be a problem. Because in such a state, the self would not feel lost. In such a state, we would recognize that we are actually the image of God. To be the image of God means that we reflect God. So we find ourselves not by looking at ourselves, but by looking at Him. So there's not the problem of self-consciousness. And as we look at Him, we won't fall into the crisis of self-consciousness. We would also see that the very language of image which the Bible uses when it refers to us communicates something very important, and it's this. An image is nothing in itself. We are the image of God. What's an image? An image is nothing in itself. When you stand in front of the mirror early in the morning, what you see there is not the reality, and you might be very glad of that, to know that. It's not the reality, it's simply a reflection of the real. And the image exists only in relation to the one that it reflects. And that reminds us that the self is nothing apart from its relationship to God. I'm stunned by the fact that we're called an image. We're nothing except in our relationship to God. Then we become everything. And unlike any other creature in the cosmos that doesn't have this problem, we can find ourselves only as we look beyond ourselves to the one we reflect. The self is just an image, nothing apart from Him. If we were in our right minds, our right emotions, we were right spiritually, we would be constantly looking to Him and finding our sense of self in Him. Now, when Adam and Eve sinned, Genesis 3 reminds us that something happened with respect to the self. What happens when they sinned? For the first time, they became self-conscious. Don't get too hung up in the nakedness bit. It just means they looked and they were conscious of themselves for the very first time. They knew that they were naked, that self-conscious, and they were filled with shame. You see, sin caused them to turn away from God, in whom the self was secured, and instead they turn inward and face the problem of self-consciousness, the fact that the self cannot be understood, it can't be fixed or placed because of this triad. And ever since Genesis 3, the human race has been struggling with the problem of self-consciousness. How do we fix the self? How do we find a place for it? How do we know ourselves? I contend, though, that this, however, has become much more problematic than ever before in the modern world. I would contend that because the pre-modern was in touch with the real, in touch with objective reality, he and or she was not excessively conscious of self. There wasn't a hyper-self-consciousness. They were still dealing with that which was outside of themselves. The other, the real, the objective, still existed in a meaningful way for the pre-modern. And that meant that self-consciousness did not overwhelm them. This, however, has changed in the modern world. In such a world, the self has withdrawn into itself. And in this, we have become hyper-self-conscious. It means we feel more than ever the burden of our lostness, that we can't be placed or fixed. And we feel the loss of our identity like never before because we're so conscious of ourselves. In the words of Walker Percy, we are lost in the cosmos. Lost in the cosmos. You see, the more self-conscious we become, the more aware we are of our lostness, that we're not placed and we can't understand ourselves. And then the more lost I feel, the more self-conscious I become. So that means I try all the harder to try and understand myself. And yet the more I try to place myself, the more it eludes me. Now what I've just played out there is known as a tautology. It's a circle, a vicious cycle you can't escape from. There's no way out. It goes round and round and round and round. The more self-conscious I become, the more lost I feel. The harder I try to understand myself, the more self-conscious I become. That's the circle. That's the tragedy for me of the modern self. And I believe it reflects what's happening in the myth I talked about earlier, the myth I retold. When I'm preoccupied with myself, I can't turn away. I'm trapped. And the end, I end up destroying myself. Now, I think this is illustrated rather shockingly in the modern world. You can call the 20th century uniquely the century of the self. Never has there been a time when we focus more on the self. And yet, we're as lost as ever. All this self-consciousness hasn't brought us any closer to self-understanding. And I love the way Walker Percy talks about this. Let me read you a few tracks from this book. This book's called Lost in the Cosmos, The Last Self-Help Book. The Strange Case of the Self, Yourself, the Ghost Which Haunts the Cosmos. Or, How Can You Survive in the Cosmos About Which You Know More and More While Knowing Less and Less About Yourself? This despite 10,000 self-help books, 100,000 psychotherapists, and 100 million fundamentalist Christians. Or, why is it possible to learn more in 10 minutes about the Crab Nebula in Taurus, which is 6,000 light years away, than you presently know about yourself, even though you've been stuck with yourself all your life? He says, imagine you're reading the newspaper. You come to the astrology column. He's got pages of these examples. You may or may not believe in astrology, but to judge from the popularity of astrology these days, you will probably read your horoscope. According to a recent poll, more Americans set store in astrology than in science or God. Now, you're Aries. You open your newspaper to the astrology column and read an analysis of the Aries personality. It says, among other things, you have the knack of creating an atmosphere of thought and movement unhampered by petty jealousies, but you have the tendency to scatter your talents to the four winds. You say, quite true. I am like that. Suddenly you realize you've made a mistake. You've read the Gemini column, so you go back to Aries. Nothing hurts you more than to be unjustly mistreated or suspected, but you have a way about you, a gift for seeing things through despite all obstacles and distractions. You also have a desperate need to be liked, so you have been wounded more often than you will admit. You say, quite true. I'm like that. The first question is, why is it that both descriptions seem to fit you, or for that matter, why do you seem to recognize yourself in the self-analysis of all 12 astrological signs? He goes on, can you explain why it is that there are, at last count, 16 schools of psychotherapy with 16 theories of the personality and its disorders, and that patients treated in one school seem to do as well or as badly as patients treated in the other? While there is only one generally accepted theory of the cause and cure of pneumonia, and only one generally accepted theory of the orbits of the planets and the gravitational attraction of our galaxy and the galaxy M31 and Andromeda. Hint, if you answer that the human psyche is more complicated than the pneumonia and that the human white cell response of the galaxies or Einstein's general theory of relativity, keep in mind that the burden of proof is on you. Or if you answer that the study of the human psyche is in its infancy, remember that this infancy has lasted 2,500 years, and unlike physics, we don't seem to know much more about the psyche than Plato did. One more here. How do you explain those odd little everyday phenomena with which everyone is familiar? You have seen yourself 1,000 times in the mirror, face to face. No sight is more familiar. Yet why is it that the first time you see yourself in a clothier's triple mirror, from the side, so to speak, it comes as a shock? Because you're all laughing, this is just going right home. Or the first time you saw yourself in a home movie, were you embarrassed? What about the first time you heard your recorded voice? Did you recognize it? Clearly you should, since you've been hearing it all your life. Why is it that when you are shown a group photograph in which you are present, you always, and probably covertly, seek yourself out to see what you look like? Don't you know what you look like? Goes on and on and on. He makes his point very, very powerfully, let me tell you. So here we are in a world of hyper self-consciousness. And yet, because of the problem of self-consciousness, we cannot place ourselves and find self-understanding. And this, for me, is the problem of self-consciousness which has become so relevant to the modern world. Let me move on now to my second main heading, the world as a looking glass. So far, I have asserted that the modern world has forced us to retreat into the self without trying to prove how this has happened. That's for other lectures. And I've demonstrated that this has led to a hyper self-consciousness. And I've tried to show you that self-consciousness is a big problem, because the more self-conscious we are, the more lost we feel. Now what I want to highlight is how this lostness affects the way we deal with the real. Here we are, lost in the cosmos, or perhaps more pertinent, lost in the self. How then do we deal with objective reality? How do we relate to it? And the point I want to make is this. The self, which is lost in the cosmos, uses the real simply as a looking glass. That is, a mirror. That's how it uses the real. You see, caught in the trap of self-consciousness and feeling so lost that I can't place myself, I now turn to the world around me and use it as a mirror to reflect messages back to myself. Simply put, I use the world around me as a means of finding self-understanding, or of knowing myself. And this means, by implication, that my use of the other, my use of objective reality, is purely and simply to try and place the self. And this is all that the real is good for now. This is the only way I actually use objective reality, because self-understanding has become everything, because of my hyper-self-consciousness. What I am looking for in the other is certain reflections that will give myself some sense of solidity. So I look out there, give me some sense of solidity, because I'm so lost. And that's because in my hyper-self-consciousness, I feel like a ghost. So I'm using the real as a mirror to reflect back messages into the self about who I am. Now, what this actually means is that I am no longer acknowledging the authentic existence of the real, seeing its existence as separate from mine. No. The real is simply a mirror to give me more self-understanding. So where God actually created and intended for our existence to be a response to the other, we respond to the real that's out there. Now the real is simply to respond to our existence, the self. There's an inversion here, a reversal. Now what this actually means is that we have lost touch with objective reality. We know it's there, but in the way we use it, we've lost touch with it. And I say that because a mirror only reflects an image. Reality. It reflects an image of reality. It's not the real thing. And we are no longer dealing with the real as objective reality. It's simply a reflector of the self. It gives back an image to make us feel solid, to give us some sort of identity. Now, there are thousands of examples we could use. One example of this for me would be the way that we use consumer items today. Consumer items, if you haven't noticed, make up a huge chunk of the real in the modern world. Sometimes it seems to make up the whole world. Let's take clothes as an example of a consumer item. How do we use clothes today? Well, I don't think it's primarily today about adornment. making us look beautiful and keeping us warm or cool or whatever. No. The clothes we wear are actually a means by which the self defines itself. That's what clothes have become. And I believe it's literally become true today that a man or a woman is what they wear. That's what they are, what they wear. The type of clothes we wear reflect a certain self-image which we want to reflect. So we draw from the clothes, this gives me a sense of myself, and we reflect it out again. So the self which is lost in the cosmos uses clothes as a means of gaining identity, placing itself. And so the real, the clothes, simply reflect the self. So the real becomes an image of the self. And the same could be said of so many other consumer items, cars. And not to say this is worse in England than North America, the way people use cars so much reflects the self. They gain an identity from the car, and then it reflects out. I believe today's self identifies itself with the objects it acquires and consumes. Another example for me would be relationships. The self, which is lost in the cosmos, uses the other as a means of finding itself. I don't know who I am, so I live through you, find my identity through you in this relationship. Now, the fact that you don't know who you are doesn't matter. You might have got it from somewhere else, but I'm just going to live it through you anyway. And I gain a sense of who I am in my relationship with you. Now, I believe relationships, they are especially powerful as something to reflect the self because they bring us very close to another self. And that feels authentic. And it's interesting, you know, that knowing another self is not the problem for us. It's knowing ourselves. We can still, as sign users, signify another self. It still works. Other selves and relationships can be legitimately signified through a sign. Walker Percy says again, one of the strange ironies of being a human self is that when a stranger approaches you in the street, he will in a second's glance see you whole, size you up, place you in a way in which you cannot and never will. In a second. Even though you've spent a whole lifetime with yourself, you live in the century of self and therefore ought to know yourself best of all. So we size up the other self and then we use that as something for ourselves. Now, it's this fact that we define ourselves through others in our relationships which make them so claustrophobic. And there's a whole lecture here. I'm still trying to untangle the nature of modern relationships. Mine too. Now, in both of these examples, you see how the real is used as something to reflect the self. It's simply an image now. And that means that the real has actually been lost. And you know, there's a strange irony in all of this. Because the self uses the objects around itself to gain self-understanding, it actually becomes objectified. I am what I wear. That's the objectification of the self. I am the one with whom I have a relationship. I don't know who I am, so I live through them. That's the objectified self, gaining its sense of self from objects outside of the self. And yet on the other side of the picture, the real has become an image. The self becomes objectified, the real becomes an image. It's simply a mirror to give off reflections back to the self. And what we have here again is a complete reversal of what God intended for his world. The subject becomes objectified, the object becomes image, unreal. Now, because the self uses the real as something to reflect back into the self, we pick up along the way thousands of what we call self-representation systems. Thousands of them. And our sense of self today is totally dependent on our circumstances. So what I happen to be wearing gives me a self-representation. When I put on this particular set of clothes, I have this particular self-representation system. Who we're with. If I happen to be with Steve over and against Kylie, I have a different self-representation system. The type of leisure activity we're engaged with, whether it be squash or volleyball, different self-representation system. Where I happen to be is important. At work, at home, at church, all different self-representation systems. And all this means that our sense of self is so variable. We fit between one and the other. Because we're using the real now simply as an image to reflect back into the self. And our sense of self actually changes like clothing fashion. Have you ever wondered why it is that what defined you 2 years ago? You felt so good about yourself, and today is absolutely hideous. You wouldn't be caught dead in that thing. Still fits, if you haven't put on weight like me, and it still looks okay, it's in good condition, but you wouldn't dare put it on. See, variable self, you need to find something different. In all these self-representation systems, our sense of self changes like the scenes of the traveler. We're here, and then we see another scene, and we're just passing through. As an aside, I just want to say that I believe traveling today is very much about the quest for new selves. You leave the unwanted one behind and go look for another one on your travels. So here you have a self, you don't like that one, or it's variable, you take off and find another one in another place. I think that lies behind a lot of the traveling instinct. You see, because our self-representation system is ultimately based on images, the real no longer exists, we quickly grow tired of our various self-representation systems. We trade them in for something different. So the modern is trapped inside the self, is my point, and caught in a vortex of excessive self-consciousness. And in such a condition, we use the real simply as a mirror to reflect back into the self as a way of gaining identity, a way of placing ourselves as finding something fixed, at least for the moment, that gives us a sense of solidity. Let me move on now to my third and final heading, which is the intensity over profundity principle. The intensity over profundity principle. The crisis I have described, the crisis of the modern self, has created an existential vacuum. Lost within thousands of self-representation systems, we feel so empty. Empty. You see, the reflections of the real, which we use for our self-image, don't feel very substantial. Remember, an image is nothing in itself. And to base self-understanding on an image can never work. It's here today and gone tomorrow. And that means that our self-representation systems are all expendable, like a change of clothes. Here today, gone tomorrow. And such a flimsy system for understanding the self actually makes us feel like ghosts. The modern self is so much a ghost. We live in a world where nothing is real. Everything is an image. And there's no longer any basis for something substantial about us. Now, the question in the light of this is simply, how do you make a ghost feel real? How do you make a ghost feel real? Well, as I understand it, it all comes down to an intense experience. That's how you make a ghost feel real. Every intense experience we have is something which makes us feel alive. It resurrects the ghost of self, this insubstantiality of the self. It makes us feel alive when we have an intense experience. And in a world where the self has become everything, this is all that is left to us, the intense experience. Truth can no longer give life to the self because truth is outside of the self. And remember, nothing real exists outside of the self anymore. So that means all we're left with is intense experiences. This alone can give us meaning by making the ghost feel alive. Now, because there is no truth outside of us, that means that there is nothing for our experience to be about. There's no norm to judge our experience. There's no ideal. There's no better, no worse. All we're left with is this, that some things feel better than others. You see, the intensity over or replacing profundity. So in order to bring the ghost alive, I simply search for the most intense experience I can find. Now what this means for the self is that reality is actually redefined as that which impacts me existentially. The whole of reality is reduced to this. If you feel that God is real in your experience and that he exists, then he does, because he impacts your experience. You have this marvelous experience of God. Impacts you existentially. He's real. He's real. But if you don't feel his reality, then he's not real. You see, only those things that come and impact yourself are actually real. And the idea of looking outside yourself to what is real is now a very strange idea. This profundity idea, thinking of truth outside of myself, whether I feel it or not, it's real. That's gone, because we've lost touch with the real. You know, you can talk about the truthfulness of Christianity today until you're blue in the face. But the modern can hardly hear it anymore. In fact, often they'll nod their heads and say, yeah, I think that's good. But it doesn't mean anything. Until God comes and gives them some aromatherapy, they'll never believe. The way they are now. The way we are now. You see, if the existential impact isn't there, it isn't real. Truth and reality become totally self-referential. And this means now that the criteria for the real are now simply physical sensations. Physical sensations. When I feel something as a physical sensation, I know I'm alive. Because I'm lost inside the self, lost inside the cosmos. I feel a physical sensation, I know for the moment I'm alive. The ghost comes alive for the moment. Now, of course, physical sensations are tied to my body. And that means that my search for the self will focus almost entirely on my body. And in that statement, again, we see the modern self. The self is reduced to the body and to physical sensations. That's what it's about. And that's because we've lost touch with the real. We've lost touch with the objective reality, which is outside of the self. And now trapped inside the self and choking in hyper-self-consciousness, we become lost. We become lost under thousands of self-representation systems. He said, because of this, we feel like ghosts, and only in bodily sensations can the self feel alive again. Now, this intensity over profundity principle with its focus in the body is especially seen for me in today's eroticism. How do you make sense of this erotic culture we belong to, where almost everything, with hardly any exceptions, has been reduced to the sexual, to the erotic? How do you explain that? Well, I think it's complicated a number of ways, but I think it probably comes down pretty much to this. Every time we feel the power of a sexual urge coursing through our bodies, we feel alive. The ghost is resurrected. I think if anything bore out my thesis tonight, it would be the erotic culture we live in. It's worth a lecture on its own. Think about it. Why do we live in such an erotic culture? Simply because a sexually stimulated ghost feels alive. The self feels alive for a moment. And for the modern self who feels so dead, the erotic is something you can count on for the type of physical sensation you require to make you feel alive. It works. As another example, the ghost of the modern self also resorts to violence against the self to make one feel alive. Violence against the self to make one feel alive. Self-harm is a huge phenomenon in our culture. And I don't want to be analytical about it. I've come across too much of it to feel detached from it. It's a horrible thing. But I think this lies behind it. You cut yourself and you cease for a moment to be a ghost. For a moment you feel real. That lies behind it. You go on an eating binge and then force it all up in an hour's time and you'll have enough physical sensation to bring the ghost to life for a moment. Eating disorder, I believe, this thing lies behind it so much. Physical bodily sensation. It's the intensity principle at work again. I believe the same drive lies behind the surge in drug use from the 90s. The bodily sensation makes the self feel alive. The self, which is so dead and so lost, it's alive in the moment of the drug trip. The same principle would apply to the massive participation there are in danger sports today. You jump off a high crane. I haven't done it. I'd like to. But you jump off a high crane with a bungee cord attached to it, I guess you probably feel alive. Talking to those who have done it. Ooh, you're alive. I think you see the same in modern film. As the power of cinematography reaches new and, for me, frightening heights, film can bring the ghost alive in the way it impacts your humanity, the bodily, physical sensations. And one could multiply examples in our world of the intensity over profundity principle. I think it's based, modern life is so much based on this principle. And because the modern self is so ghost-like, there's a huge market for anything that falls into this category. And because there's no norms, no values outside the self, there's no criteria for saying this is right or this is wrong. You can't do that anymore. There's no value judgments you can make. If something makes someone feel alive, it's legitimate. Why should we stop it? That's the way the argument goes. Before I finish this point, I want to make one more comment. On all of these points I make, so much more could be said, but I'm giving you a general skeleton framework. One more on the final point, the intensity over profundity principle. Because we operate today according to the intensity principle, we are prone as people to all sorts of addictions. All sorts of addictions. For me, modern Western culture is very much a culture of addictions. We have so many of them. And that's because the intense experience makes a self feel alive, and because of that, the self demands a repeat of it. So horrible to be a ghost. We're alive for a moment, the self says, do it again. Because it feels good. Take me out of my ghost-like existence. Bring me back to life. I believe intensity and the feeling of being alive that goes with it works according to the positive reinforcement model, which is where addictions operate. Once the self knows that a certain experience brings the ghost to life, it will instantly demand the same again when the ghost of self returns. It will eventually use that up and you'll have to go on to something deeper, even a greater physical bodily sensation, but it's an addiction. I believe when the self is a ghost and we're committed to this intensity principle, addictions can be formed very quickly. I'm stunned how fast they happen. Well, my point in this lecture is to highlight that this is the age of self in a unique way. Now, I have no doubt that human beings have always been selfish. Narcissism, however, as I've described it tonight, is not a metaphor of the human condition. Selfishness is. Narcissism isn't. And we mustn't use this term so loosely that it retains little of its psychological content. We mustn't equate narcissism with everything selfish. Men and women have always been selfish. We haven't always been narcissistic. This, for me, defines the modern self. And I believe that narcissism provides us with a way of understanding the psychological impact of recent social and ideological changes in our culture. And we're going to look at these over the coming weeks, those of us who are staying here. So I believe this idea of being lost in the self, the narcissist, provides us with a very accurate picture of the personality of our time. And the fact that it so much defines for me the personality of our time is obviously very worrying. And I wonder if we're not perhaps seeing the literal fulfillment of Paul's words in 2 Timothy 3, verse 1 and 2, where he says, in the last days, men, generic use there, will be lovers of self. Literally, they're going to fall in love with themselves. This, to Paul, would be the main characteristic of the human being of the self in the end times. Briefly, by way of conclusion, all of this makes up a pretty grim picture. And I hope you're asking, as I'm asking, is this all completely OTT? Fellows, are you over the top by a million miles? And I want to say, I certainly hope I'm exaggerating. I really hope I am, folks. I really hope I'm exaggerating. And yet I fear I'm not. And I have to say, most of this does not come out of books. Most of this comes through working at Labrie and dealing with real life people day after day, week after week, month after month, and year after year. And I believe this does reflect a pretty accurate picture of the modern self. And to one degree or other, this describes us all. Some of us are way worse into this modern self syndrome than others. But all of us belong to the modern age. All of us will be infiltrated by the spirit of the age, the times. So to one degree or other, this describes us all. Now, I want to give you very briefly three reasons why we have to take this very, very seriously. I'm just going to list these very, very quickly. Three reasons why we have to take all I've said tonight very seriously. Firstly, for the sake of our personal and psychological health. And that seems to spin us back into self-consciousness, doesn't it? Maybe it's the wrong place to start, but that's where we are. And that's where we have to go often today. You have to find a link into the modern self in order to connect with people and then bring them out. And for the sake of our personal psychological health, we have to take this condition seriously. I've tried to show you that the worldview of self is a sickness. It's a deranged condition that we all, to one degree or other, suffer from. And because we're disconnected from the real, we really are lost. Lost in the cosmos, and perhaps even worse, lost in ourselves, living inside our heads. And never forget the myth. The myth teaches us that in being preoccupied with self, we actually destroy ourselves. And I believe that has happened. We're ghosts. We've destroyed the self. Second reason to take it seriously is this. For the sake of our spiritual well-being. For the sake of our spiritual well-being. You know, all my thinking on this subject started with the observation that the loss of spiritual reality is a universal problem today. The biggest problem I face at Labrie is this. Why isn't it real to me? I've got it all in my head. It doesn't come near my experience. Why is God so unreal? Why do I feel so disconnected from God? And because I was facing this question so often, I asked why. I asked it of myself. Why? And after thinking long and hard about it, I came to the conclusion that the problem wasn't just that people were cut off from God. They were cut off from reality. They were trapped within the self. It's only as we turn and face the real again that we can find God and the spiritual reality of a relationship with Him. So for our spiritual well-being, we have to break out of the worldview of self and re-engage with the real, with objective reality. The third reason why we have to take this very seriously is for the sake of apologetics and mission in the Western world. For the sake of apologetics and mission in the Western world. Apologetics has to take seriously the cultural context into which we speak. We take the truth into a world. You know, for me, the worldview which transcends every other worldview in the West is the worldview of self, as I said. Pluralism's there, but transcending all pluralism in the Western world is this worldview of self. And if we don't understand this, we're going to be missing the worlds of those we speak to altogether. This is where they are. They said, you can talk about truth till you're blue in the face. The real doesn't exist for them. Say, bring some guru, God himself, to give them a bit of aromatherapy, and then they'll switch on. But until then, it's meaningless. And I think we need to see also that the gospel is meaningless if the real no longer exists. And I'm saddened how much of the gospel today has been redefined by the church to capitulate to the worldview of self. We mustn't capitulate. This must pull people out of it. The gospel is about the death of a Savior on the cross, someone who really existed in time and space. It's about the hope and the future of someone who's really going to come back. That's what the gospel's about. It deals with the real, not just with the self. And I actually think much of our modern apologetic has to be very practical. A lot of my time here is how do we re-engage people with the real? People think I'm really weird because I tell them to smell the flowers. Or as Susan Schaefer McCauley says, to feel the grass between your feet. The real. To re-engage with the real. That's where practical apologetic starts. It's a lot of what we're trying to do here at Labrie, living in community, connecting with something outside of the self. Now, how we do that is the subject of another lecture and a very important subject to tackle, too. But that's as far as I want to go now. There, I think, is the self at the end of the 20th century. Let me turn this off. And perhaps before we come to questions, we can just pray together. Let's pray. Lord and Father, there are so many privileges that are ours and belonging to the modern world, and we don't spurn those at all. There is so much we have to enjoy, and so many good gifts you have given us. And yet we can't ignore the plight of the modern self, and we're all modern selves here tonight. And Lord, we pray that you would help us in this vortex that we're caught up in today. You would help us to not get caught in hyper-self-consciousness, but to turn outward and to turn ultimately to you. Thank you so much that we do reflect you. We are the image of you. And Lord, we pray that you would help us to, in Dick Kai's words, go beyond identity, beyond that question, to focus on you. And in that, Lord, teach us that we can find our true self, not in being self-conscious, but in actually being conscious of you. So please help us. We live in a world which is very frightening. And we meet so much of the consequences of living in such a world. Lord, give us compassion and wisdom and help each one here to more and more re-engage with the real. Thank you for the gift of the real, the birds that are singing outside at this very moment. Thank you for the gospel, which is real also, a real Savior, your Son who died in history, for a real hope, which is as real as we are in this room. And Lord, we pray that you would make these things more and more true to us, and that you would help us to escape this intensity principle by which we so easily judge the whole of reality. So we pray this together now, in your Son's name. Amen.
Right. Whoops. Questions? Angus?
I just wanted to... wanted to know, Andrew, what your comments would be on what Paul has to say about dying to self and having the world crucified to oneself and being crucified to the world actually relates to your lecture tonight.
Yeah, I think it relates very directly, although his language isn't actually about dying to the self, it's dying to the flesh. And that's actually quite an important distinction. I think the same principle holds true. I think I've talked about the problem of self-consciousness, and that's a very real problem. Some theologies of spirituality have, I think, also completely negated the human self in it all, and that is a problem on the other side. Although I feel that in a proper focus on the real, and especially on God, there'll always be a sense of self, a solidness. You're not going to be as terrified about who I am. But I worry about a spirituality that actually completely negates the self altogether. So for that reason, I'm careful with the language of dying to the self. It's actually dying to the flesh, which is a whole modus operandi of living independently from God. So it's connected. The flesh operates this independence principle out completely. And it's actually out of the problem of the flesh that the problem of the self arises. So I'm connected in that way. Anybody else want to comment on that? I think Paul does deal with it. But I also think Paul belonged to an age, and it's very hard. I have to be careful. These are sweeping generalizations. I didn't belong to Paul's time, so I don't know what the problem of the self was back then. But it's interesting. I haven't done a lot of work in this, but those who look at classical literature and the whole view of the self back then, which is so different, and my view is that for Paul and his age, the problem of the self wasn't as pertinent as it is today. So he wasn't dealing with it directly as we need to.
How would you relate it to the Hindu philosophy of realization of the self? And do you think that this 20th century session of the self has in any way been affected by the Hindu philosophy?
Thinking of the influence of the New Age into the West. Yeah, Walker Percy in his book, how many of you know the name Walker Percy? Very interesting guy. He's not a come out in the open Christian, but he is a Christian, a very serious Christian. But in his writings, you never quite, a little bit like Flannery O'Connor, sometimes you don't quite know where she is, and yet here is a woman with incredible integrity as a Christian. And Walker Percy is a subversive. He's like people like Flannery O'Connor and Dostoevsky. He wants to get inside, from the inside, and shake and rattle and so forth. So he says a lot of things in this book which I as a Christian wouldn't agree with. But he's still alive, Southern American. He wrote a number of novels too. I've only read one of them, The Second Coming. But this book was absolutely outstanding for me. And in this book, he talks about the traditional ways of placing the self. And one was the pagan way of placing the self, where you actually identified yourself with grand symbols out there. That is, and astrology comes out of this. I am Leo. I'm that star. I'm that constellation and so forth. And you identified yourself with that, which was an objectification of the self in some respects. But they weren't plagued like we are with this hyper self-consciousness. They're still relating in many respects to the real. Hinduism is the second thing he talks about, the pantheistic way of dealing with the self, where your self is authenticated by the God in you and outside of you. And I didn't reflect on it much in terms of he was saying this is a traditional way. On what that actually is. Because my view is that Hinduism inherently leads to a type of narcissism because there's actually no distinctions. Pantheism, although Hinduism is difficult to define as a pure pantheism because it has many, many gods, but its sort of worldview being pantheistic, there's actually no distinctions. There's still a distortion of the subject-object relationship. I'm God, you're God, we're all God together. That's actually breaking things down. So I have thought in the past that actually Hinduism can lead to a very narcissistic mindset. But I also want to, and I'll be doing this in my other lectures, want to say that it's not necessarily true that all non-Christian cultures are narcissistic. I think many pagan cultures have not been narcissistic. They haven't been trapped within the self. I don't know enough about Hindu cultures to comment on what the Hindu self is and so forth. But for me, intrinsic to their worldview, monism, pantheism, is a problem. It's a distortion of subject and object as God intended. Anybody else? Can you say anything? Does that help at all, Sam? Anybody else know anything on this? Want to comment to it? You talked about how much this has come in and infiltrated and influenced our Western views. I don't think it's a main influence. I trace it back to modern philosophy, the whole Cartesian I think, therefore I am. Humanism. Humanism deliberately put the self in the central. You put the self in the center, you're going to start getting a bit conscious of the self. In fact, for me, the problem with the modern self is not a postmodern problem, it's a modernist problem. It roots back to good old humanism, which is dead as a philosophy today. Nobody, or hardly any, are philosophically call themselves humanists. But the idea that man is the measure of all things leaves a huge potential problem when it comes to this hyper-excessive self-consciousness. So I actually root the problem in Western philosophy, the change in Western philosophy, back in the roots of humanism. I think the modern scientific world has alienated the self from the other, lost in the machine, as it were, and we've withdrawn in.
Most of these gurus that have very great influence, like
mm-hmm.
the talking of experience of understanding sexual passion.
Yeah.
And there's been a tremendous response to that.
The influences are multiple. I actually think because of that, behind all of it is the most masterful piece of satanic strategy that we've seen in our world. Now, he won't win. We know that as Christians because we believe in truth outside of ourselves. But I believe it's a satanic conspiracy of the highest order. If you can lock someone in the worldview of self, you've won a tremendous victory. God is lost. God exists outside of the self. The gospel's lost. Truth is lost. So, I have seen more and more influences, and I'm sure that's one of them, but they're myriad.
Are you at all concerned that many so-called successful and fast-growing churches seem to provide a very experiential type of service, if I can talk about that, where people go along almost to be entertained?
Yeah.
Do you find that disturbing?
Yeah, I find that very troubling, not least because determining the distinction between what is a genuine experience of God and what is just a simulated experience is very, very tricky. So it makes our judgment call very hard. But I want to be careful. I think the casualty rate in the church is high on all sides. But the casualty rate in those churches which really go in for the intense experience is colossal. But at the same time, I want to be careful not to deny the reality, because where I started in this whole thing was, why is there such a loss of spiritual reality? If God is real, I ought to have an experience of him. Jonathan Edwards' Religious Affections. So we're not moving away from the experience, it's just, why aren't we having it? Now we can simulate that, as I said, or we can engage with the real and actually know God personally in a very real way. But my relationship with God doesn't depend, or it ought not to depend, on the intensity of the experience. So those mornings when I wake up and, poof, God's a trillion miles away, it doesn't matter. He's still there. I still pray to him, talk to him, depend on him, and so forth. That's because I'm trying still to believe in the real outside of the self. When I've lost that, when I'm just trapped in the self, as I said, he only exists when he impacts me. Now that looks like I'm swinging all over. I'm very concerned, to be honest. That the church has actually set itself up for the narcissist. for the modern self.
And of course, then what happens is sometimes people who go find that experience isn't actually satisfying.
Yeah.
And yet people around them say, well, you can't have those faith because you're not experiencing what I am.
Yeah.
So your faith is obviously poor or incomplete.
Yeah.
So the person who's actually possibly more healthfully spiritual than the other one,
yeah,
feels unhealthy.
Yeah. I find it fascinating that since the 60s, and the different waves, we've got first wave, second wave, third wave, Toronto Blessing, Pensacola, and so forth, if you look at those, and I don't want to say there was nothing in any of them, but if you look at them, everyone becomes more intense. And I have to say, after the Toronto, I just thought, where do you go from here? How do you improve on this in terms of intense experience? Well, yeah, the risk of upsetting some here, I won't tell you where I predict it may go. But the point that each one becomes more intense, I think is sobering.
Because then the pressure is on the people to conform to that.
Mm.
So even if they don't have it, they just pretend to have it.
Yeah.
It's a sort of vicious circle.
Mm.
I thought your lecture was a classic, it was British understatement of the problem when I look at the guys I work with.
Yeah.
They all buy in, the man and woman, in what one of them described as Maslow's brilliant theory, the peak of which is self-actualization.
Mm.
If I listen to you, Andrew, it's not the life that they see, it's the death.
Death, yeah.
Now, it makes for a great exciting life as a Christian working with these guys.
Mm.
But are there any silver bullets or even rusty grape shot you can do? It's self-actualization. When you get their attention, they may like it in the future.
I hope it's slim print. Buy a copy of Walker Percy and give it to them. This is not a religious book. Not a religious publisher. It was went down well in the mainstream. Caused quite a stir. Didn't do very well in this country. I'd buy this and give it to them because it just knocks self-actualization on the head. I mean, it's the biggest fiction we've ever lived with, that we can actually actualize the self. And he just shows us practical examples. It goes on and on and on. So by the end, you're just overwhelmed. You said, okay, Walker, you've made your point. I find it hard to know myself. I'd buy that book. That's more than a silver bullet. That's gold. Gold plated. Sharp.
Do you think that someone at the end of the 20th century with low self-esteem is actually more aware of reality?
More unaware?
Aware.
Aware. I mean, in terms of the logic of that statement, I wouldn't necessarily draw that conclusion, because low self-esteem is still a high degree of self-consciousness about who I am and what my value is and so forth. So it's, I think actually most people who are self-conscious have low self-esteem. Although it's interesting, narcissism, as a clinical condition, has great difficulty in placing itself. It's withdrawn into the self, and it uses the outside world as a reference point. So it's what I said, if I see you and you smile at me, I feel great about myself. If you frown at me, I have very low self-esteem. And I think we're all prone, in a narcissistic framework, to bouts of self-aggrandizement, and we can all be there, sort of, yeah, I could be Prime Minister of England and solve the Balkan crisis, to, I'm so useless, I couldn't teach my kid a thing. I mean, we're constantly swinging. Now, some people, I think, suffer far more from, or some people can suffer predominantly from just low self-esteem, because the number of messages that have been reflected back to them from the real have just been so overwhelmingly negative. But I don't think that necessarily brings them closer to reality. The other thing, too, that no one's picking me up on yet, Linda, I'm surprised you haven't picked me up on this. You have a mind that I thought would have. You probably are, but the whole question of therapy, because so much of therapy, are the implications of this that all therapy is absolutely wrong, because therapy increases self-awareness, self-consciousness. So where do you fit therapy into this whole thing?
The guys I work with are totally
therapy. Yeah.
Taking them nowhere.
I think often it does, and yet, do we? I mean, I am totally against therapism, which is actually an ideology, which is just centered in the me factor. So therapism, self-actualization and so forth, that's what I call therapism. And yet, more today, my sense is that we are so locked inside the self that to start reading Bible passages about the objective work of Christ on the cross, I mean, I'm not going to stop doing that, but that just doesn't go near them. And the way I put it is I often use, it's not just using for the sake of using, but I use the way in to the modern self. I use a more therapeutic approach as a way to actually to go in and to hook, but always with a view then to pointing them outwards. Because you can't solve your own problems by looking inside yourself, exploring yourself. Self-understanding can be a way of coming to grips with the problem, so then you go to God and you deal with it. But the whole purpose of a sane counseling or therapeutic model is to ultimately point them that way, not this way. Sometimes you have to look this way to go that way. I suppose that's what I'm saying. Linda, would you want to comment on that? Yeah. Converted. Yeah, I'd be interested to get your feedback sometime. You can do it now if you like. John?
I think there seem to be so few examples in the